Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 8th. In the fireside room this morning is Dorothy Bass. Today's session is number 99-1 and is titled Time in Turmoil, Watching the Clock at the Turn of the Millennium. Let's listen in.
My name is Dorothy Bass. I have come here from Valparaiso, Indiana, where I direct a research project on Christian formation that's based at Valparaiso University. And those of you who were here last summer in particular may know one of the products of that project, which is the book called Practicing Our Faith, which I edited, but which is really a very much a shared project with 12 other authors, including I think most of whom have taught at Holden in the past. So, and this book proposes, we started with the idea that the widespread spiritual hunger that is so manifest in our society today is in part a yearning for a way of life that adds up to something, a way of life that is good for ourselves, for other people, for creation as a whole, and also with the idea that many people who are on a spiritual quest are not fully aware of, even those who go to church, fully aware of the riches that the Christian faith and tradition can offer as we seek to live a way of life that is good in all those ways, in a very deep sense. And this book advocates 12 practices that we think together would make up such a way of life. Honoring the body, hospitality, household economics, keeping Sabbath, saying yes and saying no, and others. Testimony, forgiveness, healing, and so on. Well, when the 13 of us were getting started on this book, and we were deciding who would write on which practice, I was willing to arm wrestle anybody for the privilege of writing on the practice of keeping Sabbath. Why? Because I just felt so deeply my own need for this. My husband and I both have jobs. We have twins who are 13 years old now. No, we have very busy lives. And so I entered this group of people and explored the idea of Sabbath, biblically, theologically, socially. Why is it so hard for us now? Okay, and published this. And that's about 3 years ago that I first started putting out stuff on Sabbath and have been trying to experiment with Sabbath keeping in my own life. Because I think so many of us are so concerned about time. But I was out speaking, talking to a lot of church groups, and I came to realize that Sabbath is only one of the many things that our faith has to say to us about time and its shape and its meaning. Okay? And so over the last couple of years, I've been doing a lot of thinking, experimenting, reading, observing about the shape of time in our lives more generally, and why it's so distressing for so many of us, and what our faith can, how our faith can guide us as we seek to understand, to live better in time. Okay, and that's gonna be my theme in the session this morning, and another one tomorrow. Today, I'm hoping that we will get into some of the contours of the problem, some of the deep, I'm convinced it's a very deep problem that we have about time, and that it goes to the core of the quality of our lives and the our capacity to know God and to love our neighbor as well. And tomorrow we'll get into some of the more practical suggestions and ways in which I think our faith can guide us in living more truly and more as who we are meant to be within time. So I'm going to lay out some material and leave time for discussion and see if this makes sense within your experience, proceed in that way, okay? time is a problem. What does this mean? Well, you know, philosophers and theologians have struggled with this. What is time? You know, is it linear? Is it circular? Does it warp this way and that? St. Augustine, wonderful quotation, what is time? I know as long as no one asks me, you know, but when I have to define it, I can't. Well, that's one whole kind of concern, and I'm going to set that aside, those kinds of philosophical concerns, and get down to the problem of time as a much more practical problem. The practical problem that I have, that my friends and acquaintances have, that sociologists tell me lots and lots of people have, our problem with time is there doesn't seem to be enough of it. Okay? Just the frantic and fragmented lives that many of us lead as we try to get through a day, get through a week, get done what we think needs doing. This is true. This is apparent in my own family. It's apparent among my friends. And it's coming to be kind of a theme in a commentary on modern, postmodern culture. A great image was on the cover of Newsweek a couple of years ago. I don't know if some of you saw it. A clock that had a mother, a father, and a child as the very stiff hands of the clock. Okay? They're going around, dressed for work, and a child. They all look kind of glum, and the clock was ticking them around. Okay? They felt enslaved to the clock. I see some nodding for that. It's a perception. It's also, sociologists are saying, a fact that many, many, many people are overwhelmed by the demands on their time. A couple of books that I put up all the names of the books I'm going to mention up behind me. Arlie Russell Hochschild is a sociologist who went in and studied a huge corporation. She doesn't name it, but looked at everybody from the executives to the factory line workers and observed their behavior on the job and at home and found just grave distress and shortages of time. Whether among the people at the bottom or the people at the top of that corporation. And she wrote a book about that called The Time Bind. Another book, The Overworked American, Juliet Shore, an economist. Amazing that an economic sociology became a bestseller because it just touched a nerve. Between 1968 and 1988, the average working person, if you averaged it all out, and she had ways of adding up the housework we do plus the work that we do, the average working person added 164 hours per year to their work time. Okay? That means a whole month of extra work added into the year. Okay? Now, of course, at the same time, there are many people whose time is considered not of value and which is not, whose time is not full and whose time is even painfully not full. Perhaps unnecessarily isolated retirements. Some people work that out. And become busy and happy. Others feel very isolated and cast aside. And of course, the permanently unemployed, the poor, the very poor are others. However you look at it, there are grave imbalances in the shape of our time and in the rewards that come for our time. And I think that these affect the quality of life at all levels. A second way in which time is a problem is that it is losing its shape. Well, think about this for a minute. The shape of time, the rhythms, the repetitions, the knowing what time it is, when will other people show up, when should I show up, that's so evident in this village. You know, the ringing of the bell, there have been years of discernment about the relationship between when this session should start and when the bus should leave. really, it's gone back and forth. 10:30, 10. So you have to kind of keep adjusting. And it's when you know what time it is that you really have arrived at Holden, right? When you're not confused by the bells, but that you understand what time it is.
This session ends at 11:45, so you pick your kids up at 11:50 at Narnia.
That's right. That's been another problem. That's been
another
problem.
The first lunch.
And time, and should first lunch start at 11:50 or 12? And what is that? You know, so it's a matter of discernment. And it's a fabric. At the root of all those decisions about time is the fabric of a whole way of life, right? But the shape of time in our modern, that's going on right now, I think there's a huge thing that's going on, that time is losing its form. Now think about the simple, day begins when the sun comes up and ends when it goes down, and you know, the day and night. This means increasingly little in the world of the global market. Okay? The World Wide Web is always open. Even locally, in many communities, even in a relatively small town, Valparaiso, all-night shopping available, all-night entertainment. Television used to go off at a certain time. Of course, now it's on all the time. You know, lots of jobs. Only 55% of the people have, only 55% of the jobs in our economy are basic 9-to-5, Monday to Friday jobs. Okay, and that will be changing even more. So the shape of time is getting is really going awry. Night, day, what's that? They're going to start trading stocks at night. You know, I mean, it's just kind of nuts. Any sense of relationship to nature is waning as a result. The week, another classic way that we have shaped the time of our lives. The week, what's the difference between Sunday and Monday? Increasingly less, right? What's the difference between Friday and Saturday, Wednesday and Thursday? Now, nature doesn't know weeks. This constant, they're very arbitrary in a sense. We've become used to thinking that time comes in 7-day chunks, but there's nothing in nature that says it must. And nature doesn't observe, why should the market observe it? You know, in the kind of consumer-oriented global market that we live in. So the weeks are getting, the shape of that shape is disappearing with important impact on church life, right? The year, another very classic, it's kind of the repetitions that shape our life narratives. You know, the getting a little bigger each year and then getting a little shorter each year. The holidays. Okay, the year is losing its shape. There's a lot of people have started to comment on how many folks take their cell phones and laptop computers along on their vacations. Okay, commerce defines our holidays more than religion. Well, that still means there's a pattern of holidays in a sense, but it can be from one feast to the next with never a fast. Right, there's kind of always a sale going on, right? And that's how which is not really a difference in time. So the year loses its shape as well. Sometimes I have an image of time now, postmodern global time, being a huge sea upon which we drift, and it can just buffet us along. You know, it's just a great soup, and if we don't put down some anchors somewhere. We probably, some of us do have some anchors. Here we are at Holden, but think of the people who are just driven along by this formless, constantly consuming, constantly feasting, constantly driven sea of time. There's a lack of roots there. One of my favorite little pieces I found on this is by a poet named Noelle Oxenhandler. It was in the New York Times. And she says, in every town there are two places that are lit by 24 hours, lit by neon light, a pale clerk behind a desk, always open. One is the emergency room. The other is the 7-Eleven. Okay? And we are living increasingly in the twilight of the 7-Eleven, where we get fuel for our bodies, but not feasts and fasts, where we, you know, where the necessity to buy something in the middle of the night is very, as urgent as the necessity of the bleeding wound or the broken leg or the heart attack that takes one to the emergency room. The realm, you know, time is, I think, unhinged. And matters like these have immensely to do with the quality of our lives, who we think we are, with our well-being individually and in families and in communities and as nations and globally. Okay? These are of great great import.
Georgie, one more thing that just struck me on that was that just in the last few months, Mexico, the government of Mexico has officially eliminated the siesta.
Which
is a huge part of Mexican culture, but because of the global economy, they can no longer afford to let people take siestas.
Great. Okay. There we have it. And how many other cultural things, you know, in your town have been the victim of the time the time crunch?
You were just talking about feasting and fasting in this regard. I think also about seasonal foods.
Yes,
right. The way in which you don't know what season it is when you go to the grocery store because everything is always the same.
Great point. Yes.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes. And it's shipped all over the place at great cost in terms of justice and to those people who work. We become, all of this, becoming adrift in time also means becoming alienated from nature, alienated from place, you know, not knowing in a certain sense who we are, which cultures have always known by the rhythms and patterns of time, okay? Now, I want to go into this problem a little more deeply, but, you know, Christian faith knows something about this. You know, we have something to offer here. We know a few things about time, but we forget it, okay? Because these forces are so powerful. These forces that are tearing us loose from the moorings and washing us along on this great sea of global time, which has its tentacles into us more and less depending on where we live. But I think probably those with little economic power are often now forced to work all kinds of hours. Those with lots seem to be invested in this kind of time. So, you know, where do we resist this? Now, there's one thing you'll find just rife in every bookstore, and you know, when we bring this topic up, is time management as a solution. Okay, time management as a solution, and that you can create priorities and make lists and turn off your phone machine at certain times we were talking about. And I think there's a certain small place for this, but this doesn't get to the root of the kind of dilemma and trouble that we're in my judgment. Think about saving time. Okay, what can I do to save time, right? In a sense, there's a banking metaphor there, right? If you save it now, you can use it for something else later. But sometimes I wonder if it's a religious metaphor as well. I mean, how can we save time? How can we redeem time? This time which is becoming our enemy, our pursuer, you know, the rack on which we live, some of us, at certain points in time, okay? I think it's a much deeper question. There are issues of identity here. There are issues of self-understanding. There are issues of what does it mean to be made in God's image? What does it mean to be faithful people? And how our time is shaped. Okay, it goes much deeper than management. This gets down. You start talking about time very long. And we're talking about condemnation and guilt and shame and self-condemnation. I didn't get enough done. Or, you know, the workaholic, you know, condemn the workaholic, and that who may be a really great person, respond, you know, with who, if that person doesn't work a lot, other people will suffer, and is doing this, or condemn the person who slacks off. Okay, I mean, there's just lots of condemnation and self-condemnation and guilt and shame, I think, involved in this topic. It's beyond the reaches of management, in my humble judgment, okay? Which is not to say that good habits are not a good thing, but I want to take us deeper. Now, here's an image to start with. When my kids were in fourth grade, public school, Valparaiso, Indiana, which is a one high school town, they were required to purchase date books, very much like the ones that executives carry.
What grade?
Fourth. I mentioned this at an ELCA conference. A man who was there, it was a thing on public education. He was school superintendent in a similar town in Wisconsin. He said, yeah, we do that too. And he went, oh, we do that too. Okay, fourth grade. Okay, so what's the matter? I have a date book, okay, and it helps me do certain things. That's fine. Fourth grade, what are we telling them? You know, that the society plans to squeeze everything out of you. But beyond that, now think about a date book, okay? It's got lots of little boxes, one for each, you know, segment of time, depending on. And if, you know, if you're really smart, you'll X out certain ones for exercise, then you're, you know, or if you're really successful, you need a great big one. But worse than that, it's like we are standing above it and conceive, it's a way of conceiving of time. Time is a bunch of little boxes. It's an image. Time is a bunch of little boxes. We are the master of them. Our purpose in life, you know, is to fill in the boxes in a good way. Right? There's a whole image of time there, okay? Which this way of thinking, this management, not only is it not going to solve our problems with guilt and shame, but we don't need just a bigger date book, because there's whole images, ways of thinking about what time is that are embedded there. It's a mistake. I mean, it's an error. It's a falsehood that we're being drawn into.
This makes me think, Jordy, through my own childhood, of course, maybe I'm oversimplifying in retrospect, but I remember there's just two times, really, during the school day. It was school and supper. You had to be home by supper time and stuff, mm-hmm. but basically you had supper mm-hmm. and you had school. Mm-hmm. And then on the weekend, the Sunday had its own rhythm.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
but
right.
Things are so programmed now.
Yep. Okay. So the sense of mastering time, you know, we do not live above time, we live in it, right? Okay. Another story, just the images to get you thinking about this. As a, shall I say, spiritual and theological problem, not a management problem, okay? A friend of mine told me this great story. She was had a day off and was, had... And when her husband got home, there she was sitting up reading a novel, you know, sitting, feet propped up, and just drinking iced tea and looking just so comfortable. And he walked in, and she leaped to her feet and said, no, wait a minute, I haven't been doing this all day. I helped the kids with their homework. I did the laundry. I made the phone calls we talked about. And he said, sit down, take it easy. You have earned the air you breathe. Well, we don't have to earn the air we breathe, right? But we do. So it gets into all these issues of shame, guilt, and so on. Issues of shame and guilt require a faith response, not a management response. Okay? Now, what would it mean? What would it mean if we could get ourselves to see that what I think is true? Time is a given, and time is a gift. It's a given in that it comes to us in certain natural chunks, okay, which we do not control day by day, week by week, year by year, and a lifetime whose length we do not know. Okay, we do not know how long we have. And it's a gift. I mean, right at the beginning of, by the fifth chapter of, fifth verse of Genesis, you know, it was evening and it was morning of first day. It's a creation of time. Okay? God creates light, separates darkness from light, calls the one day the other night, and it was evening and morning the first day. Time is a gift. It's part of creation. And, you know, I'm going to propose that what we'll get to by the end and tomorrow is, you know, what are the ways that the Christian community has developed over the centuries that we can appropriate within the admittedly very complex circumstances of our lives now, that will remind us, by which we remind each other, of this gift quality of time. That's what these practices do. Okay, and we will get there. Because Christian faith knows some things about this, which we sorely need and which our society sorely needs. Okay? But first, let's get muck around a little bit more in some of the problematic, just to show the spiritual dimensions of this problem and what some of the faith responses might be. I've got a bunch of themes that we might consider as we think about the importance and why time and its shape matters so much to us in our lives. And here we can start to discuss things. These are some of the themes that I think come up when we think about the shape of time in our lives. Okay, morality. There are a lot of moral judgments made regarding time and its use, right? A diller, a dollar, a 10 o'clock scholar. Why do you come so soon, right? You used to come at 12, 10 o'clock, and now you come at noon. That's condemning the sense that we grow up with a sense that good people use time a certain way, and bad people use time another way, right? There's lots of condemnation around this. There's a whole journal called Time and Society, which is really cool. And a woman there did a study of the moral valences put on time, and told a story. She opened with a story of Robert Maxwell, who's the great media mogul in Great Britain. His son was late to pick him up at the airport, and he fired his son from the company. Okay. Now think of how the rage that can set in with certain people when you're late. Does anybody know someone like this, like who gets totally enraged? And sees it as a real moral issue, right? Like that's really, really, it has to do with respect and human decency, and right? It gets right down to good and bad, right? Yeah.
But I find the other side of it so often, the busy people think they're good and they're doing so much good.
Okay.
And they're so busy that it's okay if they're late.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they keep everybody else waiting. So there's that line that there can be so many busy people.
It's about good and bad, though, right? Right. I mean, I can get that way at certain times. I can also get judgmental of people who are that way. Right. I mean, so it just judgments all over the place, you know? Any other thought? Then we get, you know, political judgments that come into that also, that people who don't use their time well, or don't work, or don't do such that don't deserve inclusion in the national economy in some kind of way, right? Yeah.
Well, there's a kind of economic side too. I was thinking here of we're in a kind of a card group, and there's a couple in there in which the husband is an economist, and his wife is always late. And his objection, and it irritates him because, well, when I'm waiting for her, she's using up my time, so to speak.
Yes, right.
Or
right,
not allowing right, me to right, use my time the way right, I would like to.
Uh-huh.
So there's a kind of economic side to it as well, I suppose. But
yes,
there's a moral judgment
yes,
in all
yeah,
that. Yeah.
Well, the economic side also comes out with the Protestant ethic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that
sure.
which does say, you know, those of us who are successful have, you know, somehow been blessed by God, and the rational use of time is part of the reason for our success as well. So, yeah.
I was thinking, I've heard this often, and I have used it often. Why are you wasting time?
Wasting, that's right. Wasting.
Mm-hmm. Wasting time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, this is a good moment to move into the next category, culture. Because how much of this is cultural? You know, you go to Brazil and there's a whole different sense of what's late, what's early, right? What it means to waste time. What time is for, really? You know, what time is for? One of the neatest books I ran into on this while I was doing the study is by a social psychologist named Robert Levine, Geography of Time. And he traveled all over the world and looked, tried to understand the time cultures, and found just so many different ones. And he had this great little test where he would go to the major city in the country and do three things. One was see how close, if you take all the clocks in the downtown radius, how closely synchronized were they? Like in Zurich, they were within 2 seconds. You know, and in Brazil, which I think is the worst case from a Western point of view, you know, they were really way off. U.S. was somewhere kind of in the middle, but in terms of quantities, but, you know, really close to the Northern European side. But there were several countries that always were more timely than we. Another one was go into a downtown post office, give them a bill that's the closest equivalent to a $5 bill you can think of, and ask for a standard postage stamp, and see how long it takes to get the stamp. Now in New York, the person was so angry to be asked to get a stamp with a $5 bill. that was the end of that. But you know, in some places it's zip zip zip, and other places it's. And then the third thing he did was clock the walking speed of pedestrians on an averagely busy street. You know, are they charging along? Are they? Yeah.
I think that goes nice into my observation about time and travel, because distances are the same no matter who you are, and everyone has the same amount of time. But who I am and what I need influences what you think is. You know, you can. When I used to take the bus everywhere, people would say, "Well, Deanne, you know, that time, what are you wasting all that time taking the bus?" And now, of course, I don't take the bus anymore because I don't live in a town that has buses. That's part of it. But the way in which we think about whose time can be used in what way is really a. I suppose it's partly a matter of economy, but also cultural. If you live in a town where people walk, then walking isn't wasting time. But if you live in a town where people don't walk, walking is wasting time.
Right. And in Europe, people walk more. It's just more usual. People who might have similar jobs to the ones we have here. And someone suggested, I did a workshop, and somebody suggested that is there some relationship between being driven and being driven? That there's some wisdom in the for instance, the Jewish Sabbath observance of not driving on the Sabbath. Okay, there's something about.
And I don't know if this has any difference either, Dorothy. This may be a regional thing, but it was so striking to me. I grew up in the West, and so people would ask me how far something is. You say it's 100 miles, it's 50 miles, 80 miles. When I went out of school out east, people said, "How far is it? It's 2 hours. It's 45 minutes." I could never get people to give you the distance. Right. They give you the time it took.
Right.
People do that in Southern California.
They must, but I didn't grow up with that at all.
I think it was the moment at which you moved.
Maybe so. Mm-hmm. And it may have been also being in Montana and Colorado where you have distances and where you have spaces as opposed to urban centers. Yeah.
In Upland, they would tell you how long, not how far.
Right. One more example of this. I worship at two different churches in Valparaiso. One is an ELCA congregation where things really run on time, and people who come in late are kind of, you know, you're kind of embarrassed to come in late, and if it goes much over the allotted time, everybody gets restless. In fact, one of my friends told me about it, her church, which is American Baptist in Chicago, that she found in the bulletin one day, she found an old bulletin sitting in the pew when somebody asked her to look for something. And someone had taken in the bulletin, had written down the exact number of minutes and seconds it took for every element of the service. You know, Old Testament reading, 2 minutes and 10 seconds, prayer of confession, you know, all right on down the line. So this sense of, and on the other church I worship in is predominantly African American. And people show up, and it just takes as long as it takes, and it may not start on time. And people who, I think those of us who are more of an Anglo culture, have looked down upon those who move more slowly and don't value time and who are running late and all of that. But I've learned in this context that similarly, people who are more relaxed with their worship and with lots of other things think that I'm nuts to be so tense about, I mean, they really think this is a moral flaw on my part, mm-hmm. to be so eager to get out of there and so upset if it's late, you know, that this is something that is wrong, you know? So I guess you can see it either way. But, okay, community, let's move on. Community, isn't that true that if we don't share time, it's by the sharing of time and the sharing of a schedule, in a sense, that we become community with one another. There's none of it. You can be someone's parent, but if you don't spend some time with them, it doesn't take, right? I mean, it takes time to make community. And this is one of the things that people who are concerned about family life and other things call forth. Right? Spending time together is what makes community.
Hmm? I love going to powwows now. And the first couple I went to were so hard because I had 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And they'd start an hour later. And I'd miss it, and I'd be mad the first hour. And now I just love to go because it starts when it starts. When I arrive, it has started. I get to observe, and I just love going to powwows.
There's anthropologists talk about clock time and event time.
Okay. A question. Mm-hmm. Do you show up an hour later than you did at the start, or do you just still show up the same time and it starts when you come?
Yeah, I show up the same time, but I'm no longer...
Mm-hmm. You're not upset about it.
Yeah, okay. It's like, oh my goodness, I only have 4 hours, because I stay a lot longer.
Oh.
Yeah, well, it's tough. Now, the community thing, that's kind of obvious. Identity, that who we are has something to do with the patterns that we keep. Now, a few examples. Here we start to get into some more religious stuff. The Quakers, found in the 17th century, didn't like calling the days of the week by the names of Roman gods in whom they disbelieved. So they talked about first day, second day, third day, fourth day. And the months, first month, second month, third month, okay? These are words that we use a lot. And they thought it was important enough to do that. Similarly, the time of the French Revolution, the revolutionaries were very hostile to religion, established institutional religion. And in 1793, declared a new year one. Declared a new, whole new system of time. Said at this fall equinox, because that they were Enlightenment people, that was a rational place to start. Start the fall equinox of 1792, I think they did count from there, because that was the founding of the Republic. And renamed the months in keeping with the natural characteristics of the months. So you hear words like Thermidor as a month, Brumaire. Thermidor, that's like, it's midsummer. Brumaire means frost, it's something like March. Okay, so all of these words are taken from nature, and 10-day weeks, because 10 is a rational decimal number, we're rational people, and moreover, this would, what else could so well undermine the observance of Christianity and Judaism, but to take away the week. Mm-hmm. You know? So, it didn't take. Maybe if they'd gone to a 5-day week, so people got off more days or something, but it didn't take a 10. And Stalin tried something similar. So, and you go into a Jewish synagogue, and the worship folder will have, in most cases, today's date as we would know it, 1999, and the date of the Jewish year, which counts from what they take to be creation. It's some, I don't remember what it is right now, it's 5,700 something, does anybody know? So there's something about identity, how we position ourselves in time. Okay? how we position ourselves in time. The economy. Are you going to want to say more about identity? I'm sorry.
Well, just think about the shift now to talking about Common Era rather than B.C.
Right.
A.D.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's good. Common Era, we don't say B.C. anymore.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. This may be a little bit different, too, but I don't know if you looked at any of like the Jungian archetypes or Myers-Briggs or things like that, because I think I know my sister and I have such different approaches to time, mm-hmm. and I'm a real strong J in terms of closure, structure, yeah. order, things.
Uh-huh.
And she's just keep every option open in the world, yeah. never close
yeah.
them off.
Okay.
And so we grew up in the same family, same household, same town, same everything.
Mm-hmm.
But our experience of time is so completely
right.
different.
That's a good one. I may think about that.
Has it always been that way?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you think?
I think.
Does she have children?
No.
No children.
No.
Because sometimes that keeps, that forces you.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, the economy obviously is very important in this. And I think that in particular, the Benjamin Franklin adage, time is money. Okay, time is money. And a lot of us will spend a lot of money thinking it'll save us time. Certain devices, right? And the way in which certain people's time is valued at more money than other people's time. And that's kind of obvious, but there also are deeply embedded attitudes that I think go beyond our spending and our class status that are linked to a sense of time as money. The whole logic and structure of clock time mm-hmm. is deeply linked to the industrial and post-industrial world. Okay? It's ironic. Clocks were first invented in Benedictine monasteries in order to call the monks to prayer. Okay, and they had to pray 8 times a day, and somebody had to keep track of the hours. And they were invented for that purpose. In fact, the word clocka is the word for bells. Okay? But the ringing of those bells in that context would be a reminder of our mortality and the honor due to God. Now, take the same clock and put it on the steeple in the center of the town and, you know, make sure everybody has clocks of their own that are set to exactly the same time as that clock. And you can synchronize a whole society, okay? And you can make people, shall we say, accountable for their time. And you can start putting dollars on each piece of it. And industrial development. There's lots of scholarship on this. In fact, there's one historian at Harvard who argues that the main reason that Europe became the dominant world power is the clock. The rationality, the ability to govern time in that way is the clock. So. The centrality of the clock in modern industrial society, I think, is really, really crucial. We can start to think about things like efficiency becomes a huge value, the efficient use of time. Arlie Russell Hochschild in The Time Bind has this image of parents, it's just an image, of parents kind of having their families on such schedules, like the stopwatches. That, you know, if this family's going to get through this day, we better get, okay, out the door at this exact moment, and, right?
Cheaper so. By the Dozen, that movie and book,
uh-huh.
where they were time,
mm-hmm.
where everything was timed up.
I don't remember that. That's a great
yeah.
example. That's great. Yeah. And it is, but he's part of the same world of work that the father probably
yeah.
in that case
right.
was experiencing at the factory. Hochschild's point is that people are learning time management techniques at the office and taking them home.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids resist, they dawdle, they won't go to bed at the right time. You know, they just won't have it. And it makes the kids really upset to be put in that kind of time. Yeah.
Well, I think tied into this is the whole technology.
Uh-huh.
And having worked in offices for 20 years, I'm convinced that faxes and email just get me more behind
right.
because
right.
there's an expectation now that you'll get an instant response. In the past, you could kind of blame the slowness of the mail if I didn't get back to you because I put it in the mail, and
it's just neck. Yep, that's great. That's true.
Uh-huh. And it's interesting because we live in Colorado, and we have a daughter in New Jersey, and there's 2 hours time difference. Mm-hmm. And she has a busy schedule, works for the church, and is very... Anyway, email has been very helpful to us because she checks her email a certain time, and I know that, and I can get my message there in time. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's been helpful. Or
well, it's helpful, but...
A bonus, but you can get crazy with it, too. Mm-hmm. Find anything else, I guess. Mm-hmm. But time zones,
right?
You know, and then we have a daughter in Arizona, and they don't change time.
Right.
You know.
Well, here now, this is the kind of prudential judgments we get to. What can we do about this? Yeah. The kind of prudential judgments, where I think a day, depending on the nature of your situation. For me, I mean, I have not chosen to install the email devices at home. Mm-hmm. It's enough when I go to the office. I would not look at them. Now, if I were talking to my daughter, maybe I would. You know, which is a different thing, but I'm not. So, you know, what kinds of limits can we put around these things? Put, you know, where we'll take our cell phones, I don't have one, but I mean, people, what kinds of, can the whole society get together, and or even groups within it, and resist some of these pressures? I was standing, some of you won't be here tomorrow, so I was standing in line in Jerusalem inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to go into this marble 16th century place that's revered as the grave where Jesus lay. And the cell phone rang in the pocket of the person behind. You know, where can we put, this is a great soup and a great sea. You know, where do we put down anchors around places and times that would be, you know, better appropriate, that we can resist? It's the kind of thing where I'm not planning to completely opt out of modern time. But how can we learn from our faith ways to put some boundaries and to declare who we are in the midst of this?
And also I'm thinking about the ways in which when you put boundaries on, they take on different meaning. And in particular, I'm thinking about the phrase credit hours and the way in education we've compartmentalized, right? You're in this class for a semester, you sit in the classroom this many hours, and then when you're done, you'll know it. Mm-hmm. When in fact, education doesn't work that way, but the difficulty of that is something that's rich and sort of untidy. Mm-hmm. Gets tidied up and then you lose the content. You have such a nice container but nothing in it.
Right. And it's driven by the clock.
Right, and there's a kind of economy there that goes into morality. So if I say to my colleagues, I told my students to take the day off, they look at me horrified, like, oh no, they won't learn everything. Well,
right.
They're
not getting their money
anyway.
Right. And they're not getting their money's worth.
Right, they're not getting their money's worth.
Right,
exactly.
Let me read a quote from to take us into theology, okay, which is where I wanted to get to today. This is from Gulliver's Travel, 1726, Jonathan Swift, famous novel, right? The dawn of the industrial age, England is out there conquering the world. And Gulliver is an English merchant, washed up in Lilliput. Remember this? And the little people come up to him, and they're puzzled at this big round silver thing he has on his waist, which is ticking. We conjectured that it is either some unknown animal or the god that he worships. But we are more inclined to the latter opinion because he assured us that he seldom did anything without consulting it and said that it pointed out the time for every action in his life.
Okay? That's great.
Yeah. Now another one, but not quite, and I don't have it written down, but I think I can remember it. Bill Gates was the cover story on Time or Newsweek a year or two ago. And they were interviewing him about his life, and he was recently married, and they had a new daughter. and he said his wife wanted him to go to church. And he was raised congregational, but his wife is Catholic. And so she offered him a deal if he would go to church with their child. He could choose which church it would be. And he thought that was a good idea because he wanted it to have less, to be less religious or dogmatic or something than Catholicism, that's what he said. So he was thinking about this, but there's so much I could get done on a Sunday morning. Okay? It's the whole efficiency mentality that every minute has to count. You know, there's so much I could get done. It doesn't seem like a very efficient use of time for me to do that, he said. So there's that that
what's
sense of
side?
Time as money. I don't know. That was that was in the thinking at that point. I would, if anybody ever finds out, please please make sure it gets.
He'd been to that American Baptist Church in Chicago, I think.
Huh.
Don't you think that he was the one?
That's right, he was the one who wrote down. Right. Oh. That's right. Okay. Now, but the Lilliput quote and the Gates quote in a certain way, but especially that John just said, the time is our God. As a little bit, that's one way, but the other one is that we are the God of time now, after these many years of modernity, looking down at the boxes and making the arrangements. And here we need to just ask some theological questions, don't we? And one good way to do that is the one place that comes out very clear. We all know the what we're supposed to think at this point, I think. The Isaac Watts hymn, "O God, our help in ages past." Think of time like an ever-rolling stream soon bears us all away. We fly forgotten as a dream flies at the opening day. It's true. And these other approaches to time do not take this into account. There's no way to live well in time if we think we are immortal and can do everything and are its master. There is no way. I mean, if you're going to insist on being immortal and not having limits, never mind Christian practices for living well in time. They're not for you. But if we remember the central realities that we are creatures in God's image, mortal, we're getting started. Okay. Another verse of that hymn says, you know, before the hills in order stood or earth received its frame, from everlasting you are God, and for endless years the same. That's from Psalm 90. The whole hymn is based on Psalm 90. Gives one of the common approaches to dealing with this sense of being in flux and victimized by time, that we can flee into an eternal God. We can stake our identity in an eternal God. And there is some, I think that is one of the things the tradition wants to say. Okay. It's only part of the truth, however. It seems clear that throughout Christian tradition, the call to us is not to like find nirvana, escape out of time, be somehow transcendent over it, only think about that which is eternal. Because we're called to love and to serve here in the midst of time, right? And moreover, God meets us in time. It's one of the central claims of our faith, that God became human and lived in time, in a certain time, when Quirinius was governor of Judea, right? That Jesus gestated for 9 months in a woman's womb. Right, that when the time came for him to be delivered, that then he went to the synagogue week after week. Okay? This is real time we're talking about, and that is where God has met us. And moreover, I think that we carry with us memories of that central meeting, but also of other places in time where God has met us, in history and in our own lives. Right? This happens in time. So the time is seen in this way, not primarily an ever-rolling stream that sweeps us away, but also, and even more, the place in which God meets us.
And so, you know, how do we show up for the meetings? How do we remember that? And experience time not as enemy, but as a place of blessing. Now, are you with me on this so far, theologically? Yeah.
And it has to be a void before it can be filled. And if we're just rushing and having all that.
Mm-hmm. There are repetitions in our, as part of the ways that we, what I want to argue is that better than time management, you know, are some of the practices by which the Christian community has tried to remember that, and to remind ourselves day after day that time is where God meets us, that time is God's gift, that we live in time and not above it, that it is given to us in a limited amount, whose amount we cannot know, okay? So that we, our bedtime prayers often include reminders that we will die, okay? Yes?
I would think a couple other dimensions would be the structure of time as past, present, and future, that kind mm-hmm. of flow, mm-hmm. movement in a direction very important for our faith is remembrance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Remembering the past, and so that there's a shape to mm-hmm. time.
Right.
Also, hope for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Again,
right.
It isn't. There is the possibility of confidence.
Uh-huh.
There
yes.
is facing future uh-huh. rather than simply anxiety.
Uh-huh. Great. Yeah. Great. Now think of a Sunday liturgy. There's lots of remembering, right?
Oh,
there's
yeah.
a telling of a story. There's a piece from the lectionary that's a piece mm-hmm. of the story, but there's also a central story of the Eucharist, which is a remembering. But it's also a foreshadowing of the great banquet at the end, right? Mm-hmm. It's a foretaste of the feast to come. And it's happening right now, right? I mean, so the time in which we are is put in a perspective that remembers and that hopes
mm-hmm.
and that's going somewhere. And it's a great mystery, but it happens.
And it also transcends space. I think that's one of the things that's most remarkable about liturgical time.
Mm-hmm.
It
mm-hmm.
goes backward and forward, but it also goes across.
Uh-huh.
So that mm-hmm. even this time zone business is
right.
somehow made secondary. That
uh-huh.
you think
uh-huh.
Of course, you can try and figure it out, oh yeah, well, my parents on the West Coast won't be in worship for 2 hours, and yet there's a kind of leveling of those differences by participation in this liturgical time together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's also true of space, too. I mean, talking about the real presence.
Yeah,
yeah.
See, that we are
yeah.
bound, and mm-hmm. God isn't bound by space.
Yeah.
Right.
This Celtic thin place.
It seems, and this is what we'll do tomorrow, but it seems to me that in the tradition there have been ways of thinking about the day and its contours. Days are big enough to see as a whole, and big enough and small enough, you know, to be reflective about the week and its rhythms, and about the year and its patterns of feasting and fasting, of downtime and high time, and so on, and about the human lifespan as a whole, with the ways in which there are linkages between our baptism and our dying. So, you know, and I think that there's a whole rich fund of practices which we don't just swallow whole from some medieval rite, but which can be built into modern lives in ways that remind us who is master of time and who is not, and remind us that we're not immortals who can accomplish everything, and remind us that the clock and the global market are not the ultimate gods of our being. I don't think I'm ever going to get it all right and, you know, learn to live totally peacefully in time. But my hope would be that at least if, you know, if I show up in Lilliput, that
You know, they wouldn't think that the clock was my God. And that seems to be worth hoping for. I'm sorry, I probably talked too much. I'd love to hear some of your responses, and I will stay and chat with anybody who would like to. But I'll declare the session formally finished.
We have ended, I'm sorry.